Hey everybody, welcome to Beers with Chad. I'm your host, Chad Wesley Smith. Today, I am joined by UFC Hall of Famer, Cub Swanson. We talk about all kinds of stuff, from Cub's start in MMA 20 years ago, before MMA was even a legal sanctioned sport in the state of California. His early life, growing up in Indio, you know, from being adopted to going to juvenile hall, and you know, the kind of trials and tribulations of his life that brought him to fighting in MMA, and then overlooking his entire 20-year career, and now as he transitions as a coach and manager and still fighter with his company Bloodline, what he hopes to pass on to the next generation of fighters, where he hopes to see MMA go, as well as a lot of his favorite memories along the way. So as always, Beers with Chad is brought to you by the Juggernaut AI app. So if you want to get custom, individualized coaching that grows and adapts with you, visit juggernautai.app and use the code BEERS. Please listen, rate, and subscribe. Hope you enjoy the episode. Chad. All right. Well, Cub, thank you so much for taking the time, buddy.
Of course.
Very, very glad to have you here.
You strong-armed me to come in here, but I said, all right, I'll do it.
Yeah, we were just, the amount of sets were just going up for tomorrow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's like, the more, if you're not going to do my podcast, I'm going to make your lifting month terrible. Yeah. And I said, okay, I'll give in.
Oh, I see. We have 2 hour straight sled pulls here. But thank you so much, buddy, for coming out. Cheers.
Cheers. It is past noon, so we'll get after it.
Oof. You're more a connoisseur than me, so what do you think there?
I think that's good.
All right.
I only started liking tequila as much because my wife drinks it, and I'm like, okay, if it makes you happy, I'll drink it too.
All right.
But yeah, I've been drinking a lot of tequila, unfortunately.
Well, so I want to start. I want you to paint me a picture, paint the people a picture of maybe it's 2006.
Okay.
The MMA scene in 2006, you're fighting in WEC at that point, right? Like I think the very start of it.
Yeah, it was just the beginning, 2006, because that's when it got legalized in California.
And your first professional fight
was in 2004.
In Mexico, right? Because it wasn't sanctioned in California.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So my first three fights were in Tijuana, and then I started fighting on Indian reservations, and then it got legalized in California, sanctioned, and we were able to fight you know, with a commission. So it was legitimized. It was pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Had to do medicals and all that stuff. So yeah, it definitely changed.
Because if someone, you know, maybe they started watching the UFC in 2020,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they have no idea of what that world was like then or back then. Give us an impression of how much different that was compared to now, because you've been there the whole time.
Well, I mean, I feel like in the early 2000s, it was like a stone throw away from no rules, you know? I dove into it completely when I found jiu-jitsu. My instructor showed me all the Gracie in action videos, these videos, like home footage of the Gracies challenging other martial artists and then beating them up and like mounting them and slapping them around.
Old dojo storm.
Yeah, which was like crazy to me. And then to see a UFC fight and a Pride fight on TV going like, how have I never heard of this? And then going to one live, a smaller show at a Indian reservation, I got to see one live and I was like, okay, these guys aren't quite as good. I think I could do this. That was so shocking to me. And so I learned all of that. And now when you fast forward to nowadays, it's crazy to me that people don't know the history of the sport and how far it's come along. And to me, it's so intriguing. I'm a fan of MMA at the end of the day.
And you fought, you know, I was going through your record and everything last night. Like so many of these huge names, Charles Oliveira and Dustin Poirier and all these guys. But who is a fighter that from that earlier era that, you know, maybe he was older at that time and he hasn't been doing it for 20 years still, like mm-hmm. you, that you wish that today's fans knew more about?
Jens Pulver was one of the, you know, he was a pioneer of the sport, and I was able to fight him, and that kind of that was like a sore spot for me forever, because we fought and I lost and I didn't do well at all, and I feel like it really kind of hindered my MMA career. For it made me take a back seat, like I didn't have what it took in the, you know, the UFC's eyes. And so for a long time I stayed bitter, and I hated him because he beat me, and then my life changed, the trajectory changed for a long time. But that really helped me grow up, and me and him have become friends, and that's somebody that I know had a lot of ups and downs, but was a real pioneer of the sport, was doing things for the lighter guys so long ago. I wish more fans would give him props. But I've been able to fight a lot of people. Jose Aldo still gets a lot of credit because he's been around so long. I fought Kawajiri, who's a legend in Japan. I got respect for everybody I fought, but I've been able to get in there and dance with a couple legends myself. So that's been pretty cool.
So let's go from Indian Reservation, 2006, 2007, WEC. You know how in like a movie they have that sort of opening scene, and then mm-hmm. it looks all crazy and stuff, and then it's like five years earlier, yeah, and we wind back to that. Your road to MMA is not like what a lot of guys is now. It wasn't mm-hmm. college wrestling into, you know, trying to go to the Olympics and well, now I'm going to pivot and do MMA. It was tougher than that. It was much tougher than that. Yeah, you and I have something very unique in common, that we're both adopted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how did that early part of your life and those struggles lead you to wanting to do at that time, you know, which people were calling human cockfighting and, it, yeah. and everything like that?
Well, it's funny you say that about the human cockfighting, because that to me was what made it the most difficult for me about getting into the sport. The question you asked is such a long-winded answer. We got time. Yeah, so basically, you know,
I booked this place for 2 hours. So.
Okay. My childhood was unique in the sense that when I was born, my father had already been diagnosed with skin cancer. And so when I was 3 months old, he passed away from melanoma, skin cancer. And you know, my mom didn't take it very well. She had a really hard time. She had a daughter and then three boys with my dad. And so she, you know, didn't handle it well. She ended up getting back with an old boyfriend, and they ended up, you know, having a hard time, doing drugs, drinking. Me and my brothers were kind of getting bounced around between the family. And then ultimately my father's cousin and his new, his wife, they were newlyweds, they took us in, and it was three boys, because that was the only way they weren't going to split me and my brothers up and make us go to different families. So we actually were raised by them for 10 years, and you know, I felt like it was a really good childhood. I ended up being homeschooled and went to church all the time, kind of a real sheltered, I'd stayed away from trouble, didn't watch PG-13 movies or scary movies, anything like that. I was really into church and going to school. Yeah, I still don't. Yeah. But I ended up, they got a divorce right when I was at 13. And things started changing, and my mom had been doing so much better for years. And in that time, she had had three little girls. So my mom had a full house. She had been doing well. So we had this time where my stepfamily got a divorce, and my oldest brother had already went to live with my mom a few years back. And me and my other brother, Aaron, they said, "Do you want to move back with your mom?" And and I was open to it. And so we moved back with my mom. And then from then, it was just kind of a chaotic living situation. My older brother had been running around with gangs and doing drugs, and I slid right into that. So,
not church and PG movies.
No, it was the complete opposite, and just my mentality was just, I was so frustrated with the other side of my life, kind of like everything that I felt like I had been taught was right and wrong, was showing me like that so many people were hypocrites and that they weren't practicing what they preached, and that really kind of burned me because I believed it. I believed that all these people were very righteous people. And so it made me want to do the complete opposite and just figure things out on my own. So I had this say yes to everything mentality. Hey, you want to try this joint? Sure. You want to drink? Sure. You know, and it only took me a couple of years before I ended up in juvenile hall. And, you know, just that was quite an eye-opener. I went from going to church and wanting to go to the military to being in juvenile hall and basically fending for myself, you know, as you do when you're incarcerated at any level. There's craziness going on, and there's things that you have to do to you know, survive, decisions that you got to make that question your, you know, who you are as a person. And I just didn't like the environment. And when I got out of there, I was dead set on changing my life around. And I had kind of blown my soccer career, which was my passion all growing up. And so by the time I started to get into jiu-jitsu and I found MMA, I was all about it. And I loved it because it was changing my life. And it was making me like really focus in on something besides partying and drugs and alcohol. And I wasn't doing soccer anymore. So it was like, man, jiu-jitsu is my new passion. And when I got into MMA, everyone around was like, you're doing this cage fighting? What are you doing? Like, you just got out of juvenile hall. You were doing okay. You were going to junior college playing soccer, and now you're cage fighting. It was like, in everyone's eyes, it was like I took a step backwards. Mm-hmm. And that really like infuriated me because
there was so much at that time, I think, stigma.
Yes.
Attached to it. And to be honest, that was kind of, you know, reading stuff, and you and I have only known each other for a year and mm-hmm. a year and a half, maybe, really. As I was reading this stuff, kind of preparing, like, that was sort of my impression for it. It was just like, oh, Cub, you know, he was just getting in fights, so he just wanted to keep getting in fights. So that's why he did it. But to know that that's not the case is very...
No, it's not the case at all. And I think most of my fans kind of, when I meet my fans, a lot of times they're like, man, you're not like how I thought you would be. Because I was giving off this vibe of kind of a ex-gang member, and, you know, and that's not, wasn't really the case. The case was is that I was mixed up in a lot of it, and cousins and brothers, and it was just all around all the time. Like, in high school, I saw multiple people get shot. I had a lot of friends that OD'd or were shot by the police or shot by other people, like stuff that I didn't think I would experience at that young of an age, at 15 years old. So yeah, it was quite, I felt like I lived two different lives, you know, and but it gave me quite of an insight on people and life at such an early age. But the martial arts really grounded me and straightened me out. And just, I think the kind of the persona that I had in fighting that people kind of associate with being, you know, crazy and tough, and was really me having to go to a dark place to be able to make the walk. Because that's what people don't understand, is when you walk out to a fight, everyone's terrified. Nobody wants to lose. Nobody wants to look silly. You know, there's performance anxiety. So for me to have to pump myself up to perform, I had to go to a dark place. And so that's kind of why I would come out looking like just a mean guy. And then I was very quiet and to myself. So they just thought that I was like that all the time. Even the UFC brass was like, man, when you were young, you were like a mean little guy. And I was like, nah, just no one talked to me, you know?
Yeah. Cause before I met you, that was my impression. You know, I'd seen the Killer Cub stuff and like seen some fights and kind of thought that that's how it was. And then, you know, my impression knowing you now is so much different than that. It's, you know, with these three crazy kids running around and, yeah. and goofing around. But to that effect with the having to flip that switch, you know, on a podcast a couple of weeks ago, I talked about the most difficult sport. What are the most difficult sports in the world? And I rank MMA as the most difficult sport in the world. And, you know, I see what you guys go through, what you put your bodies through. What do you wish that more fans understood about the challenges of being a mixed martial artist?
I feel like I've really taken it upon myself as of late to be more open about like my mental, the mental side of the game and my emotional and mental struggles, because I feel like that's the hardest part. I feel like in the beginning, if you're not physically tough, you just won't make it. You're not going to last through your first couple fights. I think we would always joke around, the most common record is 0-1 because you try it once, you lose, I'm done. I'm never doing that again. And I lost my first fight. And but yeah, it's that mental battle of having to make that walk, having to prove yourself and having to lay it all on the line. And, you know, everyone that supports you is like, you got this. And they think like they're helping you, but they're really like putting this extra pressure on you, when in reality, just like, don't bring it up. I don't want to bring it up. I don't want to talk about the fight. That's something that I have to deal with. I don't want to deal with it with you. You have no talking about any family member or friend that's bringing it up. Like, unless you're in the gym with me every day, like sweating and bleeding, then I can't talk to you about the fight. If I do, it's mainly like I've flipped a switch and I'm on PR mode and I'm just talking, but I'm not like really conversating with you like I would my friends or somebody that my wife or my close training partners are the only people I really would talk about this kind of stuff with. But now I'm trying to be more open because I really feel that it's important for the younger generation to understand that not everybody is unbreakable. And all these fighters are so tough. It's like, man, it's a ladder, and you have to take every rung of the ladder to be able to get to there, you know, mentally. And that's what I try to help. And for me, I learned that when I hung out with GSP before a fight. That one blew my mind, how scared he was before the fight and how he said he didn't want to be there and he didn't want to do this. And I was just like, man, like, everyone's afraid of you. What are you talking about? You're the most dominant fighter on earth right now, and you're complaining about not wanting to be here. He literally said, coach, I would rather be anywhere in the world right now than right here right now. I was like, that's not a guy that sounds confident to me. Yeah. But that taught me a huge lesson of, man, even the scariest fighters, they're dealing with the same thing. They're just better at hiding it. And so that taught me a lot. And then I try to teach that. I try to pass that along. Like, look, the whole thing about being a tough guy or being heroic is not about not having fear. It's about having that fear and doing it anyways and performing on despite all of that. That to me is what being a hero is in that aspect.
That's very well put. The as you think about your legacy, 20 years of MMA, maybe another fight, who knows? You know, I won't put you on the spot. Get the matchmakers on the phone right now.
Yeah.
You're in good shape though. So the when people think about Cub Swanson, the MMA fighter, what do you hope that they think of?
Easy is innovative, you know, unique and just exciting. Those were like, it's crazy to me that how much you could lose focus on what you got into it for. I got into the sport because I wanted a change. I wanted something to work towards. I'm a problem solver by nature. And I've always known that about myself. In school, problem solving was my thing. Early in school, it's mathematics is very tied to problem solving. And then later it gets a lot more technical. But I've been able to problem solve my way to a long career, and that's the gist of it. And making that my passion and getting people to follow along, I just wanted to make my mark on the sport. I never really cared about being a world champion. That was never something I really dreamed about. What I wanted to see was, I loved watching Rampage and Wanderlei Silva and Shogun and Sakuraba and all these guys, their highlight videos, Crow Cup. I would watch their highlight videos and get so motivated. And whenever I saw somebody show a technique or pull off a technique in a fight for the first time, that inspired me. Like, man, I want to be the first one to pull off this move or do that. Like, being innovative was something that really inspired me. So when I fought all the time, I was always trying to think outside the box. And everyone's like, no, this is the way you do it. You got to do it like this. And it used to drive me nuts because everyone's doing the same. So I would try to do things in reverse, or I would just try my own spin on things. And I just was always trying to do things differently and have my own style. And that's what I wanted to be remembered for. I wanted people to watch my highlight videos and be like, man, that's crazy. I want to do that. I wanted it to look beautiful. And I feel like I accomplished that. I feel like that is what I'm known for, and not winning a belt. It's just kind of funny how that all plays out. But somewhere along the line, people tell you when you're in the top 10 that the belt is everything and money comes with that and all these opportunities. And so it becomes like an obsession to people. And once I had it dangled in front of my face, and then it became not as important, I started to have fun with the sport again and realize that my whole goal was to do what I've been doing. I just got distracted in the time. So overall, I'm happy.
Where it becomes a thing of people think just the goal, the end is the reward. But, you know, I think the people who enjoy their life, their livelihood, whatever they're passionate about the most, they realize, you know, the work is the reward. The journey is the reward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
100%. You know, it makes me think about like a basketball player. I've been watching a lot of Jason Williams on his podcasts, and just that guy was like, he made you a fan.
We talking Duke Jason Williams, or are we talking White Chocolate, Jay?
White Chocolate.
There we go.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. But it's like a guy like that, you're not going to remember for how many rings he had. It's not a discussion with him. Mm-hmm. With him, it's about how creative he was, how he opened up the game, how he made defenders crazy trying to guard him and trying to figure out what he's going to do. Like, to me, that has more substance than how many rings do you have? Because in professional sports, it's not everything. It's what people believe it to be, but it's really not. When you really ask like professionals in the sport, you know, you could not have a good conversation with people, because like for me, when you want to talk about fighting, when a fan's like, they're usually the first question is, do you know Connor? Mm-hmm. It's like, to me, right away, I'm like, I don't even want to have this conversation, because you're not a real fan. Mm-hmm. If you were a real fan, you would ask me a question like, what was your favorite Sakuraba fight, or what, you know, it was like, you could go so much more in depth in MMA and get like a great conversation, and you came at me with like, what's 1 + 1? Mm-hmm. It's like, geez, I don't want to have this conversation, you know? So,
your last fight, our first one working together, mm-hmm. decision victory over Hakeem Duwadu. Very emotional, mm-hmm. in the post fight interview with Joe Rogan, and you know, talking about your kids being there and all that. A lot of these guys, they're not married, they don't have kids.
Yeah.
How has that fatherhood and everything changed your perspective on what you do? What you want to do?
It's such a layered question, because like I said, my father passed when I was 3 months old. I got adopted when I was 3, and those are like my first memories is 3. I have one vague memory before that. I was staying with my grandma at the time, and there was a big earthquake, and I remember hiding under the bed. But after that, I don't have any memories until then. And the reason I bring this up is because my whole life I lived in the same town where my dad lived and everything. So I would always meet people and go, I knew your dad. And I'd be like, oh, you know, crazy. And then they would tell me a story and I'd say, wow, okay. But I didn't know this person. You know, I know it was my dad, and everyone has nice things to say, but I didn't know him. So it's just about, people are telling me about a person I didn't know. And it's just such a weird thing. Like, I wish I knew him, you know, but life didn't work like that. So for me, now that I have kids, I started having kids at 35, and my dad passed when he was 33. So already I'm like, man, I've outlived my father, and I have three kids, and I'm doing this crazy sport. And then once they got old enough, they were old enough to know what I'm doing a little bit, and wanting them to be there for a fight, just because I don't want people to tell them stories about me, about my career, and them not remember it. I didn't want them to be like, oh yeah, I've heard these stories, but it doesn't mean as much to me because I wasn't there. I didn't, mm-hmm. wasn't a part of it. So I wanted them to be a part of it. So I started asking my wife to bring the kids to the fights, which is a whole nother pressure. Uh-huh. So when you start having that doubt in that, do I still have what it takes? Can I beat this guy? And as you get closer to the fight, your demons are just, you know, you're going to lose. You know, you start having these mental battles, and then you're like, man, am I going to get beat up in front of my kids? And then you're like, man, that doesn't sound fun. So it's just a whole nother level of emotions and my reasons for my kids, me wanting them to be there, and then having to accept, like, hey, it's a part of life. If my kids see me get beat up, I'll have to explain to them that, you know, it's all part of life, and not everyone's, you know, invincible, and you got to learn how to get up off the ground and try again. So I was fully prepared to have all those conversations if I needed to, and still am. But yeah, it's different. And just the fact of my being so emotional in the cages, for me, I've always been one to really bottle things up, and I release it, you know, when I'm in the gym, you know. So me fighting and having all this bent up aggression, like building up, it makes for a big outpour when the fight's over and all that pressure is gone, and I can just be me. So in those interviews, it's hard for me to contain. And as I've gotten older, I'm more emotional, and I'm putting more on the line with my kids and my house and my wife. Like, I have more to lose now, so it's even more emotional. So I hate it. I hate doing interviews. After one hand, I want to tell everyone exactly what I'm feeling because I feel like it's necessary and a part of my journey. And on the other hand, I'm embarrassed because I can't even hold it together. But I'm just being real. I'm just being me. And to me, that's important because we have so much fakeness in the sport right now that it's very important for me to be as real as possible and just give people the authenticity of a fighter and not a gimmick and something for show.
A lot of that reminds me of a book, my favorite book. It's called Season of Life. But I have an extra copy of it at home. I'm going to give it to you tomorrow.
Okay.
You know, I like my book gifts.
Yeah, yeah. You know? I appreciate that. Yeah. Books on audio are more my thing, but I will read it.
They don't even have this one in audio book.
Okay.
So I'd looked before. So 20 years ago, make the debut. You know, I'm not breaking any news here. Coming towards the end of your career, as you look forward to the next stage of life, mm-hmm. what's that have in store for you?
So, I mean, I've been trying to get a running start on my post-fighting career because that's something that I've always thought about my whole career. Is I've always studied athletes and why they went broke and why they're depressed after, and trying to understand that so it never became a shock to me. Luckily, I had good people around me that taught me how to invest and think long term. And also because I had a lot of success later in my career, I feel like I got to watch a lot of people do stupid things with their money and be like, man, I'm broke right now. And this dude made all his money and he's doing this. Like, what is he doing? And then seeing them later struggle in life and then be like, ah, man, I remember all that. I remember telling you not to do that, you know? So when it was my turn and money came my way, I was like, put it in the bank, you know, no need to spend it, you know, and just start building. So that was a blessing for me. And then as far as I really want to pay it forward. And I get that because of the way I was brought up. I kind of mentored under Joe Stevenson. And the way he was then is he was super generous, and he would invite me up to his camps, and he would say, hey, I make the most money, so I'm going to pay this chunk. You make the least, so you pay this much, and this guy makes this much, he's going to pay this much. And it was like, you only pay as much as you can.
A very equitable system, yeah.
Yeah. And so when it was my turn, I'm turning around and paying for my training partner's food, and I'll buy him a pair of gloves, or I'll, you know, if we go, you know, out of town, I'm buying lunch, I got the hotel, you know, I'm doing those things because that's the way that I was brought up. The one who makes the most takes care of the most. They carry the most weight, and I feel like that's the way it should be all the way around. Like, you know, I'm the head of the household in my house, I carry the most weight, and that's just the way it is. I feel like fighting has really helped me with that, where I've learned to take on so much responsibility at once and keep going. And if I stumble, figure it out, get it back, keep moving forward, you know? And that's the fighter mentality that I have. And now I'm trying to instill that in this next generation of fighters. One, I'm trying to teach them how to train smarter and more efficiently, how to be good with their money, how to navigate this fight world, how to take smart fights, how to not burn yourself out. I'm trying to give them everything, all the knowledge. So while I'm still actively fighting, I've been managing and coaching, and at some point I will just transition over. And, you know, a couple years ago, I had lost a fight, and the biggest thing that stuck in my mind was, man, you really need to start focusing on life outside of fighting, in between fights, because it's just going to come a day when you're done and you can't not be ready for it. And so that's really kind of helped speed things along for me about really focusing on what I'm doing next. And that's right now managing and coaching.
Yeah. So with your management company, Bloodline, you've got kind of a growing roster of guys, but two of your most prominent guys with fights coming up in the next few weeks. Let's talk about those guys, both of whom I've know. What makes, so this is Danny Silva and Dan Argueta, what makes Danny so special and makes you so excited about his future, his present and his future?
Danny's just super talented. His biggest thing when he came to me was just he didn't really believe it, which is crazy. He always wanted to prove how good he was, always willing to, you know, he's got like an ego and he wants to go out there, but he just never really believed that he could be great. And now we're in a place where he's believing it, and he's a monster. It was accountability of trying to get him to hold himself accountable, not, well, you didn't tell me to go run, so I didn't go run. You know, it's like all of my guys, like, I have to tell them to not work out, you know, hey, pull back. Cause that's what you want. We call it the sickness, where they're so crazy. They feel like they need to be training all the time because of the nerves, they drive you crazy. That's what people don't understand. It's like, when you sign that dotted line, you have a name, and you know, that person's training, and you don't know what they're training, but they're training. Are they training harder than me? So they're constantly, I gotta be in the gym. And that's, you want that. You want to be able to have to pull them back, not tell them, dude, you didn't go train, come on. That's annoying, and I'm not going to deal with that. But Danny is there. He's turning into an absolute monster, and I think he's going to go far. Dan is, he fights 3 weeks later. Dan Argueta, he's just a hard worker and a good person that you just want to be around all the time. He's funny. He's like, when he comes in the gym, he's constantly making people laugh and just making training fun. And he's like the team leader for us. And for him, it's just about filling some of his holes and not letting him self-destruct, because he puts so much pressure on himself to be great that he can be his worst enemy sometimes. So that's been what we've been working on, is keeping things simpler and keeping him having fun. Because when he's fun, when he's having fun, he's creative. He's a monster. So I mean, we're all the same. We're all our own worst enemy. And once you find out like what the ticks are, and how to plug those holes, and how to fix them, I feel like that's probably what I'm one of the best at, as far as a coach, is understanding how people think and spotting their own downfalls, because I've done that my whole career. And questioning why you did this and why you made this mistake, I can kind of help them figure that out and patch those holes. And so that's why I'm feeling like I'm falling right into that coaching role. And these guys, I'm just happy to be around them and happy to be on their journey. Because to me, I've already like achieved my dreams. Being in the Hall of Fame to me means more than winning a belt. And now I get to help all these guys achieve their dreams. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm honored to get to play the little role that I do with you guys as well. It's a lot of fun, and I'm excited for the next couple of weeks for Danny particularly.
Well, you've been doing a lot for us, and I really appreciate that. You've helped us stay on a program and be efficient with our time. And yeah, I've seen, especially with Danny, just how much he's grown since the three of us have been working. It's been great.
Thank you. As you know, you've been in MMA for 20 years. As you look forward to the next 10, 20 years of the sport of mixed martial arts, what are things that you hope happen in that time?
I would like fighters to get paid a little bit more in general. And my reason for that is for multiple reasons. It bums me out because you pay them more, they're going to blow more money. But the ones that are smart can put it away, invest, build themselves up for a future, right? But the things that people aren't talking about is if fighters get paid more, their coaches will get paid more. A lot of coaches have second jobs, and they'd be able to spend all their time breaking down film and coming up with... I believe that if coaches got paid more, it would make the sport move along faster, you know. When you got guys dedicating their whole day to improving fighters, the sport's going to move along faster. And then managers will get paid more too. The reason why that's important is because right now the most successful managers, they have like 150 guys on their roster, and that to me is such a conflict of interest. Say you come to my guy, you manage my fighter, and you come to him and he's 145 pounder, but you have 40 of them on your roster. Mm. If an opportunity pops up, where am I on that list of 40? It's like, it doesn't make any sense. I don't think they should be allowed to have more than 30 guys. You know, like, you shouldn't be able to manage that many people. But the only ones that are managers that are really making money are the ones doing that. So if fighters were getting paid more, coaches would get paid more, managers would get paid more, there'd be less conflict of interest, I believe. And I would think that the sport would progress faster.
I think that a lot of fans, you know, unless they're really paying attention, don't realize how tough most of professional MMA fighters, whether UFC, Bellator, PFL, whatever, really have it. Like, you know, there's what, 650-ish people on the UFC roster. Mm-hmm. I would guess that maybe 65 of those, you know, 10% of them are like, they're doing very well. Mm-hmm. But the overwhelming majority, you know, and as you're explaining, the fighter is paying the coaches. They're, mm-hmm. Everyone is their own independent contractor. Their own small business.
I'd say on average, a fighter's paying 30% to managers and coaches on average.
Yeah.
And then, not including taxes, obviously.
Yeah. And that's always one to include.
Yeah.
Yeah. That it's a very, very tough existence. And then you have, you know, you get injured. Like, I don't know if you know, Danilo broke his collarbone yesterday, mm-hmm. but then it's like, all right, you get injured and You either take a fight, while you're injured in a compromised position, or you push it back and push it back. But, you know, there's no check coming when you push it back.
Yeah.
And there's no, you know, UFC health insurance.
Yeah.
And there's no pension and there's no nothing. Like, if you don't fight, it's you get nothing.
Yeah.
And it's, so it puts so much pressure on guys to fight when they're pretty severely compromised in some situations. So yeah, I would hope from my role and my perspective, you know, that the fighters at all levels, but particularly the more entry levels of stuff who are one day going to be headlining pay-per-views,
yeah,
are able to get more support from the promotions.
Yeah, especially it's really tough for lower promotions, you know, because there's so much. I've been involved on some smaller shows, and it costs a lot of money to do a small show.
Mm-hmm.
And to think that you're going to make that back on ticket sales is quite a task. You would need sponsors and ticket sales, and that's why, you know, the guys that can sell tickets get catered to on the small show, because that's everything. But yeah, I would like to say that there's a lot of talk about the fighter pay. It's crazy because in boxing, they'll make even a lot more, right? But I feel like there are more MMA fighters making a decent living than boxers. I feel like boxers make a ton of money, but only, I'd say it's like 1%, you know, actually make the money, and the rest are just barely getting by.
0.5% probably even.
Where not UFC, all MMA fighters across the board, I feel like there's, I'd say like it's like 30, I'd say a way higher percentage are making a decent living.
Mm-hmm.
Not as many are making the millions, but there's a lot more making a decent living. But I still think we could get that up higher. And I mean, even if it was like getting some kind of, you know, retirement plan where when you did retire from fighting, you got, you know, another chunk of your money, just because some of these guys, they need to be saved from themselves, you know?
Yeah. And do promotions provide any type of education? You know, like NFL, they're going to have their rookie symposium stuff, and as soon as they get drafted, they're, you know, watch out for this, and this is, you know, everyone's going to come at you asking to, you know, start a record label with them and do all that stuff. But
the UFC used to have a yearly summit, and then they started slowing it down, and I've been to a couple of them, and it's actually was pretty cool. I definitely think they could do more, but what the ones I went to, I was able to hear one of the guys from the Shark Tank talk. I heard Kobe Bryant and what's his name? Michael Strahan talk. Then they had a credit guy come in, and I ended up doing the extra work and talking to the guy and being friends with them. And he actually helped my credit for like 2 years, just cause I talked to him, and I have a pretty good credit score now, but he taught me all about credit. I took advantage of it, but I'm so proud of it, because listen, part of my family stuff, somebody stole my identity when I was 7 and didn't ever pay their rent. And so when I tried to get my first place, my mom ended up kicking me and my brothers out when I was 17. And I had to live on my own for the first time at 17. And we were trying to get an apartment, and they ran my credit, and they're like, oh, you have bad credit. We can't rent to you. And I was like, what do you mean? I've never had a credit card. Yeah.
I'm not even 18. I'm not even allowed to have.
And the lady gave me attitude, and she was like, oh, so you didn't not pay this bill? Like, it was like almost 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And I was like,
when I was 7?
Yeah. I was like, what? And then she realized what she said, and she was like, okay, moving on. So I didn't get my first credit card till I was like 27, like deep in my WEC career. Mm-hmm. I got a Macy's card, and they're like, most people get approved for 500. And I was like, cool, because I need to build my credit. And she was like, you got approved for 200. And I was like, okay, that's a start. And then when the economy started going bad, they dropped it down to 100. And I was so angry. I'm like, what am I going to buy at Macy's for $100 and put it on credit? Like,
what kind of sales you guys got going on?
But that was my only credit card. Where's the clearance rack at? Exactly. That was my only credit card. And I made sure I paid it and I made sure I didn't miss a bill. And I made sure like my whole time of being broke and struggling as a fighter, I made sure that my credit was something, because I knew that when I did get money that it was going to be important. And it did. It paid off quite a bit. And I'm proud of that. Super proud of that.
That is good. That is an important flex.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I teach that class at the high school with those kids and trying to get them on that stuff. So I'm going to play that clip for them. Maybe they're going to listen to you better than me.
Good. But yeah, like I said, I got taught. And I only got taught about, you know, how to do the credit and what they were looking for and all the ins and outs because I contact the guy and I asked questions and it sounded like I cared. Same thing with all the stocks and stuff. I remember it vividly. My guy at Morgan Stanley would call me, hey, you got a second to talk? And I'd be like, just finished my third practice of the day. And I'm like, yeah, I got an hour. And I'm like starving. And then he's just talking to me, I like this, you know, this company because of this. And you know, and using all the terms, and I'd be listening to him for 45 minutes and I'd just be like, oh man, what the fuck is he talking about, you know? And then within a couple of years of just always answering the phone and always having those conversations that were like I was kind of in and out of, I finally would be like, nah, I don't want to make that trade. It's too soon. I don't like that company. I'd start like having conversations with him to where I was like running my own account. And he would just ask me my opinion. So that's the kind of stuff that I feel like anybody could do, is just when you actually try and you actually care.
Do you know who Junior Bridgman is? He is the fourth wealthiest professional basketball player ever.
Okay.
You know, Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, LeBron, Junior Bridgman. And Junior Bridgman never made more than $600,000 in a season in the NBA, playing for mostly the Bucks back in like 70s and the early 80s. And during the off season, he worked at a Wendy's and learned all about Wendy's. And then took his NBA salary and bought a Wendy's franchise and bought more and more and more Wendy's franchises till he had like 250.
Wow.
And then I think bought the Coca-Cola bottling rights for all of Canada, something like that. Yeah, maybe you're going to be the Junior Bridgman of MMA.
I mean, that would be cool.
That would be cool.
But I mean, those are the kind of stories I love, because it's about people going above and beyond and not just waiting for something to fall in their lap and really, you know, shooting for it. I mean, I was pretty early on my stuff. I had I was making with Damage Control. I was making a couple dollars per mouthpiece, and I was making quite a bit of money per year on selling mouthpieces.
I have a Damage Control mouthpiece.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I like their mouthpieces, but they were making Killer Cub ones, and I was making quite a bit of money. And then before Connor made the whiskey, I had made a beer, but my only connections was a local brewery, and it ended up being a pretty big hit, and they stopped producing it. So I dropped the ball on that one. But I mean, I was constantly trying to just get my logo out there and trying to brand and do my thing. And I was just learning a lot, having fun with it. And I think if I would have hired a team, I could have done a lot more with it. But I was enjoying just doing it myself, just me and my manager, just little side quests, you know. And it led me to do a lot of cool things with golf, and I was able to meet all kinds of people and do fun stuff. So I've been pretty happy with that.
We do need to get out and golf.
I know. Yeah. I know.
We'll have golf highlight clips. We'll post them another day.
Nice.
You got any last thoughts you want to share with the fine folks of the internet?
Oh, has it been 2 hours already?
Not quite, but.
No. I mean, I don't know. I think I'm ready for more questions once I start drinking more tequila.
I got to think of more questions then.
What's your thoughts on lifting for MMA.
Lifting for MMA. So the overarching point of it is that all the training has to work together. Mm-hmm. And this is for any sport, but I think the MMA fighters have a harder time with it because typically you guys are dealing with so many different coaches. Mm-hmm. You go into one jiu-jitsu coach and one, you know, Muay Thai coach and a wrestling coach and a strength and conditioning coach. And a lot of times those people don't know each other, you know, and they don't communicate with each other. And if they do communicate with each other, they don't do it well. And they all think that they're the most important coach, mm-hmm. you know, because people who compete in sports for a living, they got egos. And people who coach professional athletes, they got egos too. And I know that my role as strength and conditioning coach is the least important coach that you have, because you don't have to bench press, you don't have to squat, you don't have to power clean, you don't have to throw a med ball, whatever, to be a professional MMA fighter. You have to train MMA. You know, mm-hmm. you got to punch people and wrestle them and do jiu-jitsu and all that stuff. So the role of lifting for MMA is to support everything else. And then, so in doing that, I try not to be tied to specific exercises. I think when people first know of me as a coach for not powerlifting, mm-hmm. and I'm guessing that you were probably in the same category.
Yeah.
That you're like, this guy's just going to make us lift heavy as hell all the time.
Yeah.
You know, that's because they think that's all that I know about, or that's mm-hmm. all that I did. But my background is sport performance coaching before I was a powerlifter.
Yeah.
And so I'm not married to the idea that we have to squat, bench, and deadlift heavy or at all, even. Mm-hmm. That, you know, the barbell back squat is a great exercise. It's the best exercise if you want to win a powerlifting meet, you know, if you want to squat the most in a powerlifting yeah. meet. But until they start throwing barbells into the ring for you guys, like, it doesn't matter. So if it's belt squat or front squat or goblet squat or split squat or whatever, do something that you can create some, you know, produce some force in mm-hmm. that you can do safely. Because if there's one thing about MMA fighters, it's your bodies are all fucked up, you know. The, like, you're remarkably healthy for a 40-year-old professional MMA fighter.
With that many fights?
Exactly. Like, I mean, when you do like a bodyweight squat, your knees don't even sound like, you know, a bag of popcorn.
Oh, yeah.
So so choosing exercises that allow you guys to work around whatever is going on in a bigger long-term sense. And then even that day, you know, like if Danny comes in and he feels all run down from that day, then okay, maybe, you know, it's reducing the load, it's reducing the volume, it's changing exercise that maybe is a quote unquote easier exercise, but he can do it, you know, a little bit more comfortably for the day and try hard at it that day. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, beyond that, it's like, let's move some stuff fast, your body fast, first off, mm-hmm. jumping, then throwing medicine balls is going to be, you know, such a simple exercise to learn where you're producing a ton of force and, you know, releasing a true explosive exercise. Because even if you're trying to lift weights as fast as you can, you attach bands or chains or whatever you want to it, like the bar is still going to stay in your hand at the end, but medicine ball is flying out of your hand. So it's mm-hmm. like pure explosive power. Same thing with, like, we do all those explosive push-ups and whatnot. So, you know, moving fast, because if just being able to lift the heaviest was what mattered, then you would be interviewing me as the pro MMA fighter.
Yeah.
You know, but it doesn't matter that much. So
well, you did all right.
Yeah. I mean, I almost had the debut that time down at Gladiator, but
I mean, yeah, you should have. That would have been for a better story.
That would have been a better story.
Yeah.
But
yeah, almost.
Yeah. Yeah. But so doing, you know, moving fast, doing enough heavy stuff to support that, but it's not, you know, it's not a strength sport. So the diminishing returns for heavy strength training is pretty early and, you know, increasing some injury risk with that. And then, yeah, knowing where lifting fits in the role to it, you can't, it's got to support the other training. It can't take energy away from it. And different times, you know, if you're in a true off season period, like, okay, yeah, we can dial back, you know, especially if someone needs to lift harder, like 10 weeks, you know, 16 weeks ago for Danny, it was like, all right, we're going to do a little bit more volume and put on a couple pounds here. But, you know, early when I first started training jiu-jitsu and MMA guys in like 2009, 2010, it was just like, let's fucking crush them with the gnarliest conditioning circuits.
Yeah.
And this is going to make a really cool YouTube video, you know. Mm-hmm. But like looking back at it now, like how, you know, when it was Philippe and Ottavio and Homolo and Kyron and all these guys coming to train together, and then they're competing with each other that much harder. And then I'm thinking about how hard they're training jiu-jitsu. And then in the, my, which is training, which has never been as hard as that. And I'm thinking about what I was having them do. And I was like, I'd have been taking a nap for like 2 days after that stuff. You know, I was not stimulating. I was annihilating.
Yeah.
You know? So at least beginning to train jiu-jitsu definitely gave me more perspective on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then just a better understanding, I think, of what you guys need.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you're spot on, because I've trained a bunch of different places, and it's so crazy because, just to give people some perspective, I mean, strength training wasn't in everyone's routine until about 5 to 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was only some people lifted, you know, and a lot of people we'd be like, idiot, you know, because they'd be all jacked, but they couldn't fight, you know, and that was kind of the perception 20 years ago. And that now it's like everyone does strength training. Like you have to, just what style are you doing? And then in that time, I didn't lift. I wasn't a believer in it. And then I just ran a lot. And then I started lifting, and then I stopped because I felt like I got slow. And then I did it again, but then I made some adjustments with bands to kind of do the fast twitch. And I realized, oh, that's so much better. And then I got really into lifting on unstable surfaces, you know, like Bosu balls, and being like, balance is more important than pure strength in our sport, because we're constantly moving off our center line, and being able to generate the same amount of power as when I'm centered versus off center. So I've definitely been loving, you know, picking people's brains and figuring out different techniques. And I think you're spot on with the way you're approaching it, especially for like such a broad, this is my theory for fighters and not this fighter or this fighter. Because when you start narrowing it down to one person, you could definitely get more specific for each person. But just hearing your overall thoughts on the whole landscape of fighting, I think you're on the right track for sure.
When Philippe was first saying, oh, you should go to this guy, well, you're not going to hurt my feelings.
No, so
what are your thoughts?
I was like, I told him I needed to find a new strength conditioning coach, and he was like, oh, what about my guy, Chad? You know, he does the juggernaut training. And I was just like, well, he's pretty big. I don't know if I want that. And he was like, he laughed, and he was like, no, I've been doing it for years. And I was like, okay, and how do you feel? He said, honestly,
you think that this could be made? This is boring, bro.
He said,
10 pounds at birth is set up this way.
Okay. Well, what sold me is he said, look, he's like, Cub, I've been training the same, like, not the same routine, but I've been on his training system for this many years. I just don't get injured anymore. And I was just like, I like that, because to me, that just, it told me so much in one statement, that it's about efficiency. It's about training the right things. If you're never getting hurt, you're not overdoing it. And then I'm looking at him. This is somebody that rolls with anybody and everybody at all times, morning, night. Like, this dude just always rolling, always giving you a hard go. And it's like, he never gets tired. He never is like, oh, I had a long day. Like, he's just always solid. So I was like, well, whatever he's doing, I'm willing to give that a shot. And then when I talked to you, I think I told you the first thing I said was, I just need to make sure you're somebody that'll listen, because that's something that I've had trouble with, is coaches not listening. That's like a pet peeve of mine. Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons why I started coaching, is when coaches don't listen. It's like, I'm not making excuses. I'm not a pussy. You know, that's not how I made it this far. Don't question my toughness.
That one is always mind blowing to me with, I mean, any elite level athlete, but MMA fighters of all people. Mm-hmm. And I feel like to Danny, I always have to reiterate that to him from the standpoint of like, it's okay to pull back a little mm-hmm. bit here.
Yeah.
You know, like when I'm encouraging him to do that, which is often,
yeah,
you know, it's like, there's no way that I'm going to think that you're soft.
Yeah.
Because you want to do 10 pounds less.
Yeah.
With these pieces of metal.
Yeah.
You spent the 2 hours previous to this hitting and getting hit in the face.
Yeah.
Like, trust me, I know you're tough. Like, and then, you know, to be as experienced as you are, why wouldn't someone listen to what, you know, has been yeah. successful for an athlete for, you know, 2 decades?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just common sense. Like, so put it in perspective. When I was in Albuquerque, we started using this because, you know, managers, a lot of times people bounce around, coaches, but strength coaches for sure, they have their, like, everyone goes there and now everyone goes here and now mm-hmm. everyone goes here. It kind of like keeps changing, right? I think people fight to fire people when they start losing or whatever.
Strength coach always gets the blame first.
Yeah. But we were working with this chick in Albuquerque. And she was super nice. And I always wonder, like, who let this girl in here? She was crazy. But I liked her. She was a nice person. But she started training a bunch of the fighters. We were going to the pool. And we were doing these swimming exercises. And she was putting these paddles on her hands to make, they almost make you sink.
Okay.
So you're paddling. You have to do a double. You start sinking. And then we were having to hold our breath and go down to the water and then come back up. And I was like, I hated it. It was mm-hmm. terrible. And so I was like, why are we doing this? Explain this to me. If you're going to make me almost die in here and drown, tell me why I'm doing it. What benefits? Oh, it's going to make you tougher. I'm already tough.
Yeah.
I'm tougher than you are. So don't tell me that. And she's like, you need to learn how to hold your breath in a fight. And I said, absolutely not. I don't. Yeah. I need to learn how to breathe when I'm stressed. Like the opposite of what you're saying right now.
And then Naaman has been liking to do the smother to people, but
yeah. But that's like worst case scenario. Yeah. You're in a choke. You're holding your breath. You shouldn't have been there.
Yeah.
You know, so that's usually at the very end, but learning how to hold your breath did not make sense to me. And that just infuriated me. And then I'm literally watching all these top-notch fighters do this workout with this person. And I'm like, this girl, she doesn't even know what she's talking about. She's crazy. She's just trying to be relevant. And then it just made me start like questioning. And I've always questioned coaches. And I tell my fighters, question me. Like, if I can't explain why I'm telling you to do it, then maybe I just don't know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And I guarantee that a lot of coaches are out there. I know there's a lot of coaches out there that are just trying to make you tough. And they don't know what else to teach you. But you're already tough. You know, if you weren't tough, you wouldn't make it to the big show. You just wouldn't. Sure. So why are you questioning their toughness? You should be making them better. Save the toughness for the fight when they're there and they need to pull out a win. That's when you need to have that toughness there to pull that out. But if you're grinding them to the bone every day in training, by the time they get to the fight, they have nothing left. You know, that's what coaches don't understand. That's what drives me nuts. And that's why I hope people like myself and these fighters are going to be retiring soon, that we take over and elevate the level of MMA and get some of these old coaches that don't know shit out of here. I'm really hoping for that.
Yeah. It always frustrates me to hear coaches in any sport, in any field, you know, like, well, this is what's always worked for us. And it's like, what worked and what works?
Yeah.
Ain't the same thing.
Yeah, it's true.
All right, let's do this. Let's go movie characters, MMA fight bracket.
Okay.
All right. I'm seeing Frank Dukes in there. I'm seeing maybe Clubber Lang.
Okay.
Ivan Drago, Rocky. Yeah, so kind of pure strikers there. What's your favorite MMA movie? Or do you think the best MMA movie?
I mean, it really bums me out. Because me and my brothers love Bloodsport, kickboxer, but Bloodsport was probably number one.
I feel like Bloodsport and like listening to the podcast, the ESPN 30 for 30 podcast they did about the creation of the UFC. Mm-hmm. Like that was, you know, that was the argument that, that guy whose name is escaping me right now.
Frank Dukes.
No, not Frank Dukes. The guy who started with
the Horian Gracie.
Yeah. Who started it with Horian.
Not Campbell McLaren. He's the other guy, but I forget the third guy.
Yeah. But anyways, whatever his name was, you know, he was talking about, it's just like, cause it's the bar argument. Mm-hmm. Who'd win in a fight, mm-hmm. you know, Muhammad Ali or Bruce Lee, yeah. kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, who's going to win, the wrestler or the,
I mean, and that's why we're so entertained with these, celebrity boxing matches yeah. now, because it's like, what if you don't know? And then the crossover fights, boxing versus MMA, like I dig them, you know, like some of them are stupid, but what I don't like is the fake trash talk leading up and just like, just fight.
So are you calling out Jake Paul right now?
No, Logan Paul. I mean, ASI? they're both huge.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like I would fight them, but it's like not even, I'm sick of them fighting people that aren't even their size, you yeah. know, like it just doesn't even make sense. So I don't care if they're a pro or not. It's like, fight somebody your size. That's what we do in fighting.
So who do you think would be the best MMA fighter of any movie character?
Any movie character. Well, like I said, Bloodsport was my thing growing up. But what I have found out ever since, Frank Dukes was full of shit.
Yeah.
He never went there. The whole thing is made up. That really bummed me out. When my favorite story is, supposedly, you know, Cecil Peoples, the referee and judge, Cecil Peoples. Well, he used to do a lot more. He's a little older now. But when I was coming up, he was one of the main referees, and he judged a lot more, too. Supposedly, him and Benny the Jet jumped Frank Dukes outside his dojo because he basically came up with this whole persona mm-hmm. that he won this world championship. He was the baddest man in the world. And it was before the internet existed, so people really couldn't check on it. And so he basically was stealing all these people's students and saying, like, screw all these guys that actually competed in martial arts. And so in Hollywood, it was like a small circle, and these guys like teamed up and jumped him, which I thought was awesome. Because it was like, you know, it's like you've been powerlifting forever, and then some new guy's like, "Yo, I won all these things overseas, and I'm a god over there, and then you should come train with me, F him." And so you show up to his garage and whoop his ass. I thought that was pretty funny.
Well, powerlifters can't fight, though.
So. Yeah, but, so yeah, I don't like him, but who else? Let's see, movie character.
I mean, I think best MMA movie is probably Warrior.
Yeah.
So Tommy Condon in there.
Yeah.
But he is an MMA fighter in that, so.
Yeah. Never Back Down was cringy, but it wasn't the worst thing. But it was basically Fast and the Furious MMA version.
Here Comes the Boom.
I never finished that one.
Kevin James.
Yeah. I like him, and what's his name was in it? My buddy, the kickboxing coach, Mark Delagrotti, was in there.
Okay.
Because him and Kevin James are friends.
Did I see an acting credit or two on your Wikipedia page?
Yeah. I did Kingdom.
Okay.
That's probably the best show. It's probably, because it's not a movie, I'm not putting it in there, but it's better than Warrior, I think. Just because it's a little less about the fighting and more about the crazy people in fighting, mm-hmm. which is definitely a thing. There's a lot of crazy people in fighting.
How much crazier were, do you feel like people were a lot crazier in the 2000, you know, 6-7 era of MMA than in 2024?
Yeah, but the generation before me mm-hmm. was even nuts.
Like the
Ken Shamrocks, the okay, TOs, yeah. And my trainer Eric Paulson, the stories they would tell, and just like, just funny, just
yeah.
craziness, and because it was like less money,
Yeah, it seemed much more like edge of society.
Yeah. Like you had to be a little off to, and all of those people that I've been around that are from that era, they remind me real quick, like, oh, these guys are crazy. Mm-hmm. Like they're crazy. And I mean, I love all those stories too. I'm trying to think some of the craziness. I remember there was a guy, you remember Matt Horwich?
Name rings a bell.
He was super good. He was like a Ben Askren early on. He could take you down, had terrible striking, but he could take you down and you mm-hmm. couldn't get up. And he was kind of tall and lanky. And I would imagine he was really strong.
He like fought a weird farm strength.
Yeah. Of. He fought somebody and he was always in his interviews. He was like, not trying to be, but he was like the ultimate warrior. We talk about space and aliens. And I think he had like one famous interview that he did, but he was just out there. And I remember after a fight, the guy that he fought was telling me the story that they wanted to hang out with him afterwards. And that guy was known for not showering and always stinking mm-hmm. and stuff. But they were like, yeah, I went to tell him, like, let's go hang out. And he told his corner man, like, hey, can you hang out with us? And, you know, I'll get him to the airport. Don't worry about it. And he was like, are you sure? The corner man. And he was like, yeah. Well, I thought that was weird. Like, are you sure? And he said, okay. And he said he reaches out of his jacket and he pulls his bag. And it had, like, his wallet and his ID and, like, all his belongings. And was like, here you go. It, like, handed him off, like, the weirdest thing.
Yeah, like a kid going to camp.
Yeah.
Like, I wrote your name on the inside of your underwear. Yeah,
basically letting them know, like, oh, you're in for a hell of a night. And I just made me laugh so hard that it's like, that's the kind of people, it was the kind of people that you could go to a bar with and you don't know what's going to happen. They're going to drink, they're going to get wild, they might fight a cop, like, just craziness.
Yeah.
And so, that's the kind of mentality of the generation before me. The generation that I came from, there was a lot of wild personalities. There was a lot of people drinking and doing crazy stuff, which was baffling to me because I had already passed that stage in my life. And I was like, man, what are these guys doing? These are professional athletes. You're supposed to be, I thought professional athletes were supposed to be like eating healthy all the time. And that was not the case.
I think that there is, from an entertainment value, something that is a little bit lost now, where the fighters are a lot better and mm-hmm. more skilled and more professional. But that kind of wild card personality mm-hmm. that I think came through in interviews and everything and press conferences in that early 2010s, you know, 2010, 2014 kind of range is not quite as much, it's not quite as present now.
Well, I think social media, you know, I see all the basketball players talk about it. Mm-hmm. They're like, man, before there was social media, you know, they would go city to city and wild out. But yeah, I mean, so I come from the era of trying to make the sport seem like a sport and not like a freak show. Mm-hmm. So literally from the day I started fighting, I took it as like my job to try to tell people like how great the sport is, how technical it is, how it's misunderstood. And then we fast forward and then it became so big that now that didn't matter. And then the I feel like Chael kind of took over from what Tito was trying to do. And Chael wasn't the full package because he wasn't an exciting fighter. He was super talented, but he wasn't exciting. So he talked to make up for that. I felt like I didn't like that because mm-hmm. I felt like that was cheating. You know, it was like a cheap trick of you're not that good of a fighter. Like, you're good, but you're not exciting. Fans don't want to watch you, so you're cheating to gain some attention. And he ended up getting all these title fights because of that. But then Conor came along, and he was exciting, and he was a prick, and he could talk. So that changed the game of where...
And he won.
Yeah, and he won, and made it even when you didn't think he was, which was frustrating. because it kind of set the tone for what the next generation of fighters thought that they needed to do. And it just was like, oh, geez, here we go. Yeah. And so now we have these Colby Covingtons and these guys that are faking it so bad. And it's, to me, that's cringy. I'm not a fan of that part of the sport, but I understand like selling it. To me, it should be authentic. Because, just different mind frame. And I've told this story a bunch. Like, when I was in juvenile hall and I was at my lowest point, and when you're in there and you wanted to fight, if I was like, I got a problem with you and we're going to fight, and you started going, oh, man, you want to fight me? What? And you started putting on the scene, security would jump on you and break it up. So that everyone knew, like, oh, look at this movie star over here. He's acting, he's making movies, you know? And they would be like, oh, you're a scene maker, you know? You're just causing all this scene so that we don't have to fight. And the way I saw it was people fight in silence, you know? Mm-hmm. You got a problem? Okay, let's go around the corner and we fight and that's it, you know? And so going into the UFC at the highest level, it was like, I never had to say anything, you know? It was like, yeah, we're going to fight. We're going to see who's better. The whole shit talking just didn't, it seemed weak and childish and silly to me. And I understand that that's the game now, but it's just not something I wanted to ever be a part of. You know, I think that those people also want to be famous, and I never cared about that. I never wanted to be famous. I don't feel like I need to be the center of attention. I feel like I just.
Not like this. Okay.
Yeah.
My hair, I used to have hair like that. I got to. Yeah, I gotta redo that.
Yeah, definitely look younger there.
I think I'm better looking now though, with no hair.
I mean,
yeah, like, am I supposed to answer both that? Ways.
But yeah, that's my thought on the current state of MMA. I love this sport. I love the direction it's heading with the technique and how good people are getting everywhere so fast. Switching stances, playing—they're truly playing chess out there. And the talking is just talking. It's not my favorite part.
Well, I think on that note, we wrap up our talking.
Cool,
Cub. Thank you so much for your openness, your vulnerability in this. I really appreciate it. I think it does set, you know, teach such a great lesson to younger guys that you work with, that anyone who's interested in the sport and competing in it or just being a fan of it, of, you know, what you guys really go through with it. And yeah, thank you so much. So,
oh, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. I'm sure we'll do it again.
Cheers, brother.
Oh, finish this off. You're almost done.
I am. Well, you did most of the talking, so. All right.